Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In the first century BC, the Roman statesman Marcus Tullius Cicero claimed, "There's no statement so absurd that no philosopher will make it." Indeed, in the history of Western thought, philosophers have rarely been credited with having much common sense. In the 17th century, Francis Bacon made the point rather poetically and wrote, "Philosophers make imaginary laws for imaginary commonwealths, and their discourses are as the stars, which give little light because they're so high." Samuel Johnson picked up the theme with some pugnacity in 1751, declaring that the public would suffer less present inconvenience from the banishment of philosophers than from the extinction of any common trade. But as Samuel Johnson scribbled his knockdown in the Rambler magazine, the greatest philosophers in Britain were locked in dispute about the very thing he denied them, common sense. It was a dispute about the nature of knowledge and the individuality of man, from which we derive the idea of common sense today. But what is common sense philosophy? Who are its proponents, and how did it emerge from the tides of scepticism, empiricism, and rational inquiry running through 18th century Europe? With me to discuss common sense philosophy are A.C. Grayling, Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck University of London, Melissa Lane, Senior University Lecturer in History at Cambridge University, and Alexander Brodie, Professor of Logic and Rhetoric at the University of Glasgow. Anthony Grayling, the idea of common sense philosophy might sound contradictory to a lot of people, so could you tell us how you see it?
Well, firstly, we've got to distinguish, which is always the starting point in philosophy, between two quite different senses of common sense. On the much older one, which goes all the way back to Aristotle, is the idea that because our different senses of seeing and hearing and smelling and touching and so on give us information about a world, about objects in a world, which is unified, there must be something in the mind which makes common the data that comes in so that we get that unified experience. And that was called the sensus communis, the common sense in the mind, which makes, as it were, common cause between all the different sense organs. And that's quite a different sense of common sense than the one that we're used to today. What we mean today is very, very fundamental, general, much agreed views, beliefs, concepts about the world, which it would be absolute lunacy to deny or to reject. Common sense being, as it were, the touchstone of the ordinary person in the street.
Can you give us some concrete examples so we know how concrete we're being?
Well, that there are physical objects that we've spent most of our lives near the surface of the earth, that if you put your hand in a flame, it'll burn, and so on. These are examples of common sense beliefs that we have, which are so powerfully accredited by our ordinary experience that, as I say, it would be kind of madness to deny them.
You quoted from Fenelon in the notes, in your notes. Can you explain why you think he encapsulated it so well?
Well, he's very often been quoted because he put so nicely this idea of exactly what common sense beliefs
he's
are.
He's an 18th century French prelate and writer.
That's exactly right, isn't he? Ecclesiastic. And in the course of one of his disquisitions, as it were, as a kind of side blow to it, he said, common sense beliefs or common sense notions are those which you cannot contradict or deny or even indeed examine. I mean, they are just so basic to us that you can't call them into question and try and examine them. And yet, they are premised in all our thinking and doing otherwise. And he said, if somebody, and this might be a lunatic or a philosopher, that, you know, collection of two types of people, were to try to call them into question, then he said, all I can do is smile. You can't argue about them.
So there was some sort of construct there that he saw. How do you think that common sense, you began by talking about Aristotle, but how do you think, where do you think common sense ideas come from? I mean, basically, as I understand it, the argument is between those who think we are born with them, that they're innate, and those who think we learn them, the empiricists. Can you just discourse a little more on those two?
Yes, the way I see it is this, that in the 17th century, when the philosophical quest really revived and recapitulated some of the great debates of philosophy in antiquity, especially on the question of knowledge, the nature of knowledge, and the grounds of certainty in knowledge, and people were looking for an answer to the question, how is it that we can have beliefs about an external world which seem to work? Or beliefs about moral realities, which seem deeply important to us, or beliefs about the existence of a deity, which is so central to 17th century thinking about the world. And there were various attempts by well-known philosophers, so as it might be the empiricists, Locke and Berkeley and later on Hume, to talk a bit about how we could acquire knowledge of the world through sensory experience alone, as if our minds were, as Locke began by saying, blank slates on which experience writes. And then there were others who said, look, we've got to know certain things at, as it were, the moment of birth, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do any kind of thinking or experiencing at all. So the principles of logic, for example, very, very fundamental, very simple, very general beliefs about the world, have got to be locked in there at the beginning, because if they weren't, we just wouldn't be able to get on.
You mentioned Aristotle, but there's also Plato. There's the Aristotle-Plato, as it were, opposition. And Plato believed that innate ideas were there before we were born, as it were. They were trailing clouds of glory. It's Wordsworth, as it were, transformed. Anyway, never mind that. But Plato thought they were innate meant pre-birth, almost.
Indeed. He thought our immortal souls, when in their disembodied existence, were in immediate contact with all the great truths, and that when we are conceived or born at some point, at any rate, of becoming embodied, we forget everything. The process of education is a process of being reminded, at least partially, of some of what we knew in our pre-birth existence. And this is a very, very strong innate ideas thesis, which says that we know everything. Not merely that we have certain capacities for knowing or experiencing, but that we actually have propositional knowledge, and that this is what we forget when we become embodied.
Melissa Lane, can we turn to the 17th century, this argument where this argument was played out between innatism and empiricism? Let's take a group called the Cambridge Platonists and John Locke. Can you tell us about Cambridge Platonists and then about John Locke and what was going on between the two of them?
Well, the two great images in this debate, one, Anthony mentioned the blank slate idea from Locke, and the Cambridge Platonists countered that with the notion of reason as the candle of the Lord. So the image that God has put a candle of understanding into our minds, and we can use that in order to know the world with certainty. Despite the name, the Cambridge Platonists actually drew as much on the Stoics as they did on Plato. So they did follow Plato's idea that the mind already has certain knowledge, but they took that more in a Stoic sense, in which it was not so much that we were always born with the knowledge, but that our minds have a disposition to form certain judgments and concepts. So that might be stimulated by experience, but it is an inborn disposition, and there are sort of common notions, as the Stoics said, and anticipations that we have in our minds. So for the Cambridge Platonists, though, the key idea, and if we take, for example, Ralph Cudworth, who also knew Locke, and his daughter became a great friend of Locke, so there was real interaction between these groups, really took this idea that the mind can only know what is native and domestic to it, and that enables us to know God, to know morality.
Did they bring any evidence to bear for this? Did they bring any proof? So did they reason their way to the birth of reason?
They were reasoning their way. I think the main argument was to show that actually the other side, the empiricist, materialist, sensationalist side, that their arguments were faulty. So their arguments were to say, for example, how could you possibly ever form just through sensations alone? How could you possibly form concepts like geometry, for example? You never encounter a perfect triangle in nature. So how would you be able to form the notion of a perfect triangle? That must be an innate idea. So it's a reasoning method of attack on the alternative.
And there were moral ideas too, that you had an innate idea of justice, because how could you form an idea of, that was the argument. Will you express it much better than I could?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, the moral ideas are also among these innate ideas, so that we're not just machines for processing data coming in from the senses, but actually we have reason in our minds given by God, and that includes moral notions.
Is God always central to the idea of innatism?
Not necessarily. It's not there in exactly that form in Plato. It is arguably there in the Stoics. There's a sort of ambiguity between nature and God. I think it is crucial, though, as you suggest, that very often, perhaps not always, but very often for innatists, the way that we can have a guarantee that our innate ideas are true is because they come from God. And that, I think, does become an issue later on. You know, if one tries to dispense with that premise, it's harder to make that argument.
And then the other side, if we can carry the other side, but the counter-argument is John Locke outlining his ideas in the essay concerning human understanding. Can you tell us how he opposed the Platonists?
Yeah, so in this essay in 1690, Locke does launch a blistering attack on certain innate ideas theorists, including these Cambridge Platonists. And he really challenge this question of, if you say that there are these universal ideas that are innate, well, which ideas are they, actually? We don't agree on everything. People don't all agree even on God. They don't agree on their concept of God. They don't agree on moral ideas. So he actually went back to some of the ancient skeptical claims, saying, you know, we look at the diversity of humankind, we look at the diversity of beliefs and senses, and we can't say that there are these universals. And he also thought, I think, and argued that believing in innate ideas makes us lazy. It's a cover for just accepting certain kinds of prejudices and accepting what we're told on authority. And actually, if we think of ourselves as forming beliefs and concepts, then we're able to scrutinize those and actually test them. And that's better for our mental understanding to do that.
Was there a sense of public debate between him and them, as it were?
Oh, yes. I think it was quite a public issue, really. And as I said, also a private issue in the sense that they, Locke interacted with Cudworth and others. Quite a blistering debate in the halls of science as well as in the public domain.
Alexander Brodie, can we bring the French philosopher René Descartes to the table, literally, now? Can you tell us what part he played in this?
Well, Descartes played a particularly important part in all of this, both in fact and according to the version of the history of philosophy that everybody is taught these days, which is a history of philosophy that was in effect dictated by Thomas Reid, and we have simply swallowed the story ever since. Why Descartes is so important in this story is that he wanted to found science upon an absolutely certain base. He needed some propositional propositions that nobody could deny under any circumstance, and he eventually found such a proposition, namely the one affirming his own existence. And his philosophy develops from that.
Cogito ergo sum.
Cogito ergo sum. And the crucial phrase there is sum, I exist. He is starting, and he's starting where? In his own head. His problem is that this doesn't seem a very suitable place for founding as a basis for science, because the science he was talking about was all going on outside his head. It was about the real world. So his big question philosophically was how to get outside his head. And he managed this by constructing a series of arguments for the existence not only of a God, but of a God who has all the perfections, including the moral perfections, and who is therefore not a deceiving God, and therefore is a God who would not deceive Descartes into believing certain things when they are completely false. So with the help of God, Descartes gets outside of his head.
Now, just a second, staying in his head for a moment, it's interesting the way that he got to the basic notion, I think, therefore I exist, or I think, therefore I am. And can you describe how he did that? Because it's interesting.
It's interesting and very important, again, for the history of philosophy. He started with beliefs which, roughly speaking, are common sense beliefs in the sense that Professor Grayling has just outlined.
For instance, two arms, two legs. That's
for example, stuff. Two arms and two legs. You're sitting just in front of me. And realize that actually such propositions as these are doubtful or doubtable. Because we know very well that sometimes our sensory receptors serve us ill as well as well, just as our memory can serve us ill as well as well. And this means that those sources of information which tell us about the outside world now and the outside world in the past are not entirely reliable. So he goes on doubting and doubting until he finds something that can no longer be doubted, because to doubt the proposition in question, namely his own existence, and the fact that he is doubting, is in effect to affirm the proposition that he's trying to deny.
So when he comes to the doubt about his own existence, that's proof that he exists.
The very fact that he is doubting his own existence proves that there is himself a thinking thing, because doubting is a form of thinking, and so there is thinking going on, and so there must be a thinker who is at it.
But then he had the trouble, and I interrupted you, or brought you back, I apologise for that, except I don't, because it was very interesting, about proving, getting outside his head. And he invented the perfect God, and the perfect God, well, you say it.
Well, he got outside his head by noticing that there were inside this head of his a number of ideas. And amongst the ideas was the idea of God. And the question was then, is it possible to argue from the idea of God to the reality of God, the existence of God? So not merely a mental existence, but a real existence. Not just an existence that depends upon an activity of Descartes' mind, but a God that who has to exist for Descartes' mind to exist.
Would this be called scepticism? Or was it at the time called
no,
scepticism?
No, this wasn't at all scepticism. Descartes wasn't being sceptical about anything in the process of his doubt, and he didn't end up a sceptic, nor needed to, if his proof about the existence of God was correct. The existence of a non-deceiving God was a guarantee for Descartes that the external world existed. And this was just as well for him, given his large program of trying to construct a firm basis for science.
Anthony Grayling, we come to, well, I come to in this, David Hume, 18th century Scotland, bon viveur, philosopher, historian, darling of the Edinburgh chattering classes. But can you tell us how he took it forward or how he entered into this discussion on common sense?
Well, Alexander has just been telling us there about how Descartes got going what came to be called in the 17th and 18th century the way of ideas, the fact that what you have immediately before the mind in experience is ideas, and from these you've got to get out of your head to an external world, and that's where you need some kind of guarantor. In the case of Descartes, the goodness of a deity who doesn't ever deceive you. In the case of Locke and Berkeley, who were empiricist philosophers, a different route had to be engineered from the experience inside your head to this external world. Locke tried to do it by saying that there are certain properties of things, what he called their primary qualities, the qualities of objects that you can measure, their position, their dimension, their how big they are, how many they are, and so on, which give us direct access to objects outside our heads. And so there's a bridge in experience to the external world. And Berkeley, you might call it a mad, but at the same time beautifully argued case, pointed out that, in fact, those ideas in our minds, called secondary quality, ideas of secondary qualities, the colours and textures and so on of things, are on an experiential par, if you like, with these primary qualities. And so, in fact, our objects are collections of experience qualities, and these experience qualities can only exist in the mind. This left Hume with the very interesting problem that if you're going to be a very rigorous and thoroughgoing empiricist, and you're really going to base everything on your experience, you're going to have to trace every one of your ideas or concepts to what he called an impression, either of sense or an internal impression, from which these ideas and concepts originate. So if you're going to be very, very thoroughgoing in your empiricism, you've got to base everything on experience, you've got to try to locate the roots of all your beliefs, all your ideas, all your concepts to experience, the experience of these impressions, whether you refer them to an outer source or to an inner source. And his successors in the philosophical tradition and his contemporaries, including among them Thomas Reid, thought that this landed him in a universal scepticism, because Hume himself said in the first book of his treatise, he said, there is no way of proving the existence of an external world, or the validity of inductive reasoning, or the fact that I have a self, or that there is some necessary connection between a cause and its effect, on the basis of this very, very austere resource, which is tracing our concepts to the originating impressions.
Melissa Lane, did Hume think the senses were trustworthy? Was this a problem that he had?
Well, Hume, as Anthony has been saying, Hume was... on the one hand, committed to the notion that that is how all of our information has to come
in. So we get all our information from our five senses.
Well, but he is at the same time, I think, very aware of the ancient arguments, the ancient skeptical arguments known as Pyrrhonism, that the senses do actually give us contradictory information all the time. If I see a stick in water, it looks bent. And that was a famous ancient example. And Hume also gave the example of the diminishing table. So if I moved farther and farther away from the table would seem to be getting smaller. So for Hume, this was we had to accept that the senses, on the one hand, did give us these contradictory impressions, but at the same time, we then have to work through the understanding, and the mind has to sort of try to sort that out and create a notion of an external world despite that.
Alexander Brodie, Hume was based in Edinburgh, but there was a philosophy club in Aberdeen with the minister of the Kirk there, Thomas Reed, and they discussed ideas, particularly Hume's ideas. Can you tell us what Reed made of Hume's ideas and how he responded to them?
Hume's ideas went down, in a sense, very well indeed in Aberdeen, in the Wise Club, the Philosophical Society, because Hume gave him something to talk about. And there is a famous letter from Reed to Hume in which he tells Hume to keep publishing, because otherwise they'll run out of things to talk about. So that we have the paradoxical situation that the Wise Club in Aberdeen was a fan club of Hume's, while at the same time being totally opposed to his ideas. The reason that they were opposed to his ideas is that the Aberdonians were not sceptics, and they reckoned that Hume was very much a sceptic. For example, to pick up the point that has been made both by Anthony and Melissa, Hume was interested in the question of the proof of the external world. And it's not just that he couldn't find a proof of the external world. He was locked into position by the way of ideas that he had adopted. Within his own system, what were real were things in the mind, what he called perceptions, impressions, and ideas. And this was absolutely all that he had to work with. And in that case, if there is an external world, this has got to be a world that is somehow constructed out of impressions and ideas. So the position that Hume adopts on the interpretation of philosophers such as Comyn Reid, the position that Hume adopts is that what we are pleased to think of as reality, what we fondly imagine gets along quite nicely without us, the outside world, is in fact almost entirely a construction of our own imagination going to work on the impressions and the ideas that we have. And that means that in effect, each of us is a creator of the world. We are all of us world makers. And so that the world, the external world, stands to us roughly in the way in which a novel stands to an author. And it's not surprising in that case that on several occasions in his philosophical magnum opus, The Treatise of Human Nature, Hume speaks of the external world as a fiction. And he means fiction in the modern sense. It's something that we have made, something that we have created. And that clearly is scepticism in a very tough sense.
Anthony, and then I want to go to Melissa.
Well, here you see Melvin and our listeners find themselves fallen among thieves, you see, because here is a point of to philosophers at any rate, absolutely vital interest as to whether this indeed is what Hume was trying to say, because a slightly alternative picture to this would be to say that what Hume was sceptical about was the possibility of rationalist, with a capital R, philosophy to provide us with arguments. I mean, philosophy is an enterprise of reason which could provide us with proofs of the existence of an external world and causality and so on. Because, of course, he also says in the treatise that when he gets up from his study desk and goes off to play backgammon, which was his favourite occupation, he couldn't help but believe that there is an external world. And so what he was implying there was that our human nature, this is why his book was called A Treatise of Human Nature, actually equips us with convictions about these very, very basic things, like the existence of an external world, which cannot be called into question. It was this insight that the great Immanuel Kant picked up on and turned into, as you would expect from a Teuton, a tremendous, elaborate philosophical system. So it may be that Hume wasn't at all a sceptic about the external world, but about the pretensions of reason to prove it.
Can I come to Melissa for what, just to say a little bit more about Reid, because he was very influential in this, and he wrote a book, 1764, Inquiring into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common Sense, and it was a very influential book. What was common sense philosophers developed by Reid, Miss Lane?
Well, it's interesting. Hume read a draft of the Inquiry and wrote in a letter that this was reviving innate ideas. So Hume took it that Reid was just going backwards, back to the Cambridge Platonists and the innate ideas. But that wasn't at all what Reid took himself to be doing, or not exactly that. Because Reid rejected this very notion of the ideas, the way of ideas that's been mentioned, the thought that the only thing that's real is the impressions in our mind from the outside world. He wanted to restore a direct connection between ourselves and external reality. And he did that by these common sense principles. So he does have innate somethings. They're innate principles, but they're precisely not innate ideas in that sort of Locke and Hume sense. And so for Reid, the common sense principles are principles like you exist and have a mind. This table is real. I exist. I can have reason to trust my senses and testimony generally. And Reid actually picked up the Fenelon thought to say that people who deny these really are either lunatics or what he called metaphysical lunatics. They are these mad philosophers because, in fact, we can't ever reason or think without these premises. So we have to accept that this is part of the constitution of our minds.
Alexander Brodie, do you want to come into as you know, the Scottish representative at this table, what became a national quarrel? Can you just develop what Melissa and Anthony have said about this?
Yes. Firstly, and perhaps mainly, I would like to respond in a Reidian kind of way to Anthony's interpretation of the history of philosophy, in that Anthony's report is obviously perfectly correct, that on the one hand there was Hume writing his philosophy, in the course of which he was declaring the external world and therefore all his friends to be a fiction, a product of his own mind. And on the other hand, he was leaving his closet where he was writing his philosophy and going out and playing backgammon and talking with his friends. Now,
in the real world, in the common sense world.
In the common sense world, in the real world, exactly that. Now, for Reid, this means that there is something seriously dislocated going on. As far as Reid is concerned, what this demonstrates is that there's something desperately wrong with Hume's philosophy, because it's not a philosophy that you can live. If you actually do think that your friends are products of your own imaginative activities, and that's the end of the story, then you can't possibly treat them in the kind of way that nature forces you to treat them, namely as other centres of consciousness and centres of moral principle and so on. And it's an essential part of the philosophical insight of the common sense school that there should be a unity between the life that you live in the real world and the philosophy that you practice. Sorry, the philosophy that you theorize about. So Hume's life demonstrates the weakness of his philosophy.
Well, Melissa, you're both bursting.
Okay, go
Melissa
first,
ladies.
Well, there is a paradox, though. Just as Kant and Hume in one way could be brought together, as Anthony suggested earlier, so in a way Hume and Reid could in another sense be brought together. And there was a wonderful 19th century Edinburgh story that said that really what happened was that Reid was shouting out very loudly, "We must believe in an external world, but we have no reason for our beliefs," whispering. And then Hume was saying very loudly, "We have no reason for our beliefs," and whispering, "But we must believe in an external world." So there's a sense in which one can argue about, are they in some way saying the same thing?
Can I second that? Sorry, Mum, because I think that's exactly what
we're having
the
a meeting here.
Yes.
Back in the Wise Club in Aberdeen.
Because Alexander's absolutely right. Of course, that is exactly what Thomas Reid did think, and this was the great talking point. But in its way, they were, as Melissa suggests, talking past one another, because they're much, much closer, in fact, than they thought they were. It was, I think, Hume, in his letter to a friend, a mutual acquaintance between him and Reid, talking about the Inquiry, which was the first of Reid's works, and Hume didn't have an opportunity to see the more developed works that Reid offered, had taken Reid to misunderstand him when he talked about the way that the empiricist project had to be worked out, that the fact that the only equipment we have before consciousness are these ideas and the impressions that from which they originate, and that if you were going to try to make a philosophical case for saying that basic beliefs were all in order and were fundamental and that you could reason from them, that you were giving too much to philosophy, that what you should instead be giving the laurel to was just the way human nature is built. It's not a matter of philosophy, it's not a matter of reasoning or argument at all, it's just a matter of responding to the experience that we have.
Can I just come back before we move on, Alexander Brodie, to this notion that if you have a philosophy, it should be philosophy that you live by. And if, was that notion very much around? Was Reid going back to that notion that you have to live the philosophy that you write about, that you think is the interpretation of the world?
It's an ancient philosophical concept. The Greek philosophy has this very well developed as well, that a philosophy that does not articulate with what we naturally think of as the real world has got something seriously wrong with it.
Melissa?
I mean, having suggested that there are ways in which human read are very similar, I think it is important also to say there are some ways that they are very different on some points. And, for example, in this question of the relation to God and miracles, so Hume had argued that we have no grounds on which to believe in ancient biblical reports of miracles because there's no reason for us to trust that testimony unless we have experience of its reliability. And Reid really countered that, saying actually testimony is just as basic a way of knowing about the world as our senses are, and in fact we need to have a principle. We can't escape having a principle of believing in testimony. And so there were some real differences between them.
This perturbation of thought in Scotland broke out of came across the wall and across the sea, and then started to make waves across Europe, most particularly, as you've already mentioned, Andy Grayling, with Immanuel Kant. I think that you're on your own, you three, from now onwards, with Immanuel Kant and his critique of pure reason. See what I mean? his critique of pure reason. How did that develop the idea of common sense, and was he directly influenced by reading Hume?
Well, Kant was certainly influenced directly by what he had heard of Hume. Kant was one of those philosophers who probably didn't actually read and study very carefully his predecessors, but he read about them. And he claimed to have been inspired, indeed to have been woken up from his dogmatic slumbers by this idea that it is the way our human nature is constituted that gives us our most fundamental beliefs and about the world and responses to them. And Kant, as I say, turned this into a very, very elaborate and extremely powerful and interesting system of thought. And he did it on the basis of a crucial change. Whereas the empiricists before his time had asked, where do our ideas come from, in order to try to locate the authoritative source of them? If they came from your neighbour next door over the garden fence hanging out the washing, then they weren't very reliable. But if they came through your five senses, then they were reliable. And Kant said, no, don't ask that question, where do they come from? Ask instead, what work do they do? Bit like John F. Kennedy, you know, don't ask whether you can do for your country and so on. So he picked out a set of very, very fundamental and very, very general concepts, which he called categories, because they're so integral to all our thought, to all the possibility of experience, indeed. And he said, these are constitutive structural features of our minds. The concept of objects in space existing independently of us, the fact that they are in causal interaction with one another, the fact that there is a plurality of them, one or many of them.
Non-fictional.
So on. Yeah. And we are committed to taking it that the world is like that, that it has these objects, that they are causally related. Because if we didn't have these concepts, then we just couldn't be having experience at all.
Alexander Brodie.
I think Thomas Reid would certainly say yes to some of the ideas of Immanuel Kant that Anthony has just mentioned, but at the same time, I think he would say no to some quite basic things about Immanuel Kant's position. And most especially, he would certainly interpret Kant as being a continuator of the tradition of the way of ideas. And that's because Kant speaks on almost every page of the first critique, the Critique of Pure Reason, of representations in the mind. And the point about these representations in the mind, so they are mental events or mental acts, is that they are quite orderly. They are not completely chaotic. And his question was, how is it that they are orderly? The point about the orderliness is that it's through these representations as ordered that we know the world, and really that this is what the external world is all about. But two things about this. One of them is that the one of the bases of this thought are the representations which are in the mind, which are Descartes' ideas and Hume's impressions and ideas. And the other thing is the principles of ordering, which are what Anthony has just been speaking about, namely the a priori categories of the mind, such things as the as external substances and the relationship of causality. So again, it's all coming from the mind. And in that sense, for Immanuel Kant, what we are doing is making the world that we live in.
There is an important point, if I can just jump in for Melissa here. Just a point of clarification, which is, if you think about the word representation, re-presentation, that somehow on the screen of the mind, pictures of a world out there which we don't have direct access to are being played out. So that there is this virtual reality in the head, and that this is a theme through everything we've been saying. And that is precisely what Thomas Reid rejected. He didn't think that there was an intermediary, a veil of ideas. It wasn't the case that we were locked away inside our craniums and there we were seeing this television show going on, an external world. He really thought that we had direct access to the world outside. And this is a key point for understanding him and his difference from both Hume and from Kant.
Melissa Lane, the utilitarians would seem to have had a lot to offer to common sense philosophy. Jeremy Bentham's Introduction to the Principles of Moral and Legislation in 1789. What did they bring? What did they bring to this argument?
Well, there's a sort of paradox here, because in one way, one might say that, well, the utilitarians are looking for the sort of one big, great principle of common sense that they think that no one can deny, which is that the rule of our action should be to do that which increases the greatest happiness of the greatest number. But on the other hand, they didn't think that that was something that everybody actually did agree to. They thought that that was something that people might disagree about, and we have to use it as a skeptical weapon, or a kind of critical weapon, rather, against a lot of the ordinary prejudices, assumptions, conventions. So on the one hand, there's that relation, but the other thing that happened is that one of Reid's successors, Sir William Hamilton, was developing Reid's ideas in the 19th century, and John Stuart Mill, one of the great utilitarians, launched a blistering attack on him in a book, and it was probably that attack which really put paid to common sense philosophy, at least in Britain. So there's a kind of paradoxical relation.
We've left out the religious element in Reid's thinking. He was a minister of the church, Anthony Grayle, and that obviously, and I'm told that almost every page of his book the word God appears. How did that link up with innatism?
Well, I'm not sure how direct the connection is with an innatist doctrine, but there is certainly a kind of political background to this, which is that the Abidonians, and Alexander is going to put us straight in this, he is a great authority on this matter, were committed members of I think the Kirk. They were certainly all of them Christians, and they regarded Hume with respect, but also with a certain tinge of horror, because he was known to be an atheist, and therefore their charge of scepticism against him wasn't only one that related to epistemology but also to the faith. Hume, by the way, in this discussion, as Melissa was talking a bit earlier about miracles, said it's quite a mistake to think that the age of miracles is long past, because the one miracle remains, and that is the miracle that anybody still believes. And so it was this, of course, which I think irritated the sensibilities of the Abidonians, and they assimilated the idea of scepticism about the external world to scepticism about the existence of a deity. And I think therefore, and Alexander will put us right on this, a great deal of the thrust of what the common sense school was doing was to make room for the idea that a belief in the existence of a deity and providence was part of the common sense furniture that any ordinary mind would be equipped with.
Alexander, you've been Asa Girding has passed on the baton quite neatly.
Yes, I think there are one or two things to say about what Anthony has said. If I may start with Hume, I think Anthony and I can have a discussion as to whether Hume was or was not an atheist. I'm not sure it was possible for Hume to have been an atheist. Hume was a sceptic about almost everything, and I think he was a sceptic on matters of religion as well. The phrase attenuated deist is quite often used to describe Hume's position. That's to say that what he does in his main work on religion, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, is not at any point raise even the question whether God exists, but instead what he does is ask whether there are good arguments for the existence of God. And he says, in effect, well, there aren't any good arguments for the existence of God. So what that does is undercut a most important swathe of theological argument that's been going on for centuries. But on the other hand, there were Calvinists who were quite pleased at the conclusion of Hume's position, because they thought that it's all a matter of faith in the blood of Christ in any case, and not at all a matter of argument and reason whether you believe in the existence of God. And so you have a space created for a form of fideism, if that's what you want. So Hume hasn't stopped that. It's just that he's prevented something else. He's sceptical about the power of reason, which he keeps describing as a frail intellectual organ.
But can I ask you, Lisa, as we come towards the end of this programme, where you think the influence of common sense philosophy has been most profound?
Well, there's quite a profound influence, for example, in G.E. Moore, another Cambridge philosopher, but in the early 20th century, one of the apostles, who made a very similar sort of argument to the ones that Reed was making. So he said, if we have the proposition, there is at present a living body, which is my body, he said it would just be lunacy to deny that. And he sort of held up his hand and said, you can't deny that this is a hand. So that notion, and that, in some ways, one can see that idea that there are some things that it's just crazy to question, and it just doesn't make any sense for us to question it. We couldn't live it. In a broader sense, also, that feeds into some of the ideas of the later Wittgenstein as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, Moore famously, of course, even the title of one of his works, In Defense of Common Sense, is a direct inheritor of this tradition. Mm. And indeed, Wittgenstein, in his last work, On Certainty, is also an inheritor via Moore of Reed's ideas, again, indirectly. But there's a famous case in which Moore, having used such examples as, I know that I have a hand here and another hand there, and I know that I've been, you know, close to the surface of the earth all my life and so on.
He was giving a lecture at
an American university in a great hall, the walls of which were hung with curtains. And he said, I know with absolute certainty that there are windows behind these curtains, and in fact there weren't. And this just shows you how risky common sense is.
Finally, where do you think its influence is most felt at the moment, Alexander Brody?
Well, it is very often spoken of with respect, if not awe, in the United States, where Thomas Reed has now been taken over in a very major way, particularly by philosophers within the Reformed community, and partly, I think, because of a certain field of philosophy known as foundationalism, that there are foundational beliefs, and their theology accepts foundationalism as a fundamental part of it.
Well, thank you all very much indeed. Thanks, Mr. Lane, Alexander Brody, and A.C. Grayling. Next week, we'll be looking at the Permian-Triassic boundary in geological time, when 96% of life on Earth became extinct. Thanks for listening. Good morning.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/radio4.